This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota. And today we're going to start talking about health, and specifically things that are good for you or maybe not good for you. Some things indeed are poisonous or toxic all the time. Never drink bleach. Some are okay in small amounts but can be problematic over time, like too much copper in your diet. Naturopathy is a form of alternative medicine which, as the name implies, uses natural and non-invasive treatments to promote self-healing. Today, naturopathic Dr. Ali Swabany discusses toxins and their effects on the body, including the brain. She spoke with Main Street's Ashley Thornburg.
Dr. Swabany, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Ashley.
Let's start with a definition. What are toxins?
Well, toxins are there are a couple of types of toxins, but generally there's something that affects the body negatively, something the body has to try to get out. There are exogenous toxins, which come from our environment, what we breathe, what we eat, things that are absorbed through the skin. Some examples of exogenous toxins are aluminum, copper, mercury, manganese, cadmium. And then we have endogenous toxins, which are produced by our body, so they come from the inside. We have bacteria, fungus, naturally living in our body but can be overgrown to unhealthy amounts. So those would be endogenous toxins. And we also have things that are naturally produced by the body's normal processing. Those things can actually become toxicants if we're not removing them optimally.
Okay, we're going to go into more detail about the differences between exogenous and endogenous. But after finding out kind of what they are, we should figure out why they're bad. What are they doing to our bodies?
So what toxins are doing is negatively impacting the normal functioning of the body, of the mind. So really what we're finding more and more is that they make us more susceptible to some of the chronic diseases that are very common. Diabetes, infertility, heart disease, autoimmune disease. Toxins affect these diseases long-term in the body. So long-term exposure to toxins can affect us in these ways.
So is it safe to say that where you live can impact your health? I mean, I'm thinking back when bars still allowed smoking and you'd go out, and for a non-smoker, you would just be having a headache and you'd feel miserable all the next day. If you're living in somewhere that's, I don't know, maybe next to a landfill or underneath an airport or something that produces a lot of that, can where we live impact our health?
Yes, absolutely. The air is a big source of toxins because, you know, we breathe how many hundreds of times every day? I don't know. And that air coming in, filtering through our lungs, some of the things in the air are very difficult for our bodies to rid itself of. And I always talk with my patients about, you know, the overall body burden of toxins. So I think of it as a big cup or bathtub full of toxins, or not so full of toxins. We only have so much capacity to be able to process in any given 24-hour period, right? Or over the course of a lifetime. So if we expose ourselves, if we live next to an airport and we're also eating food that's high in toxins, and we're also
smoking
and we're doing all these things to burden our body further, at some point the body burden is going to be too much, and that is when we run the risk of chronic disease states coming into play.
So things like headaches and coughing, those make sense to me. How can toxins impact our fertility?
Good question. So the hormonal system, the endocrine system of our body, is of the utmost importance. It's a massive system. All the hormones we produce regulate our sleep and wake cycles. They regulate, obviously, our menstrual cycling if we're women. And those glands do take up so much blood and nutrients that when we have a high body burden of toxins, they accumulate a lot of toxins as well. Some of the research on that topic, I believe, has come out of places where there have been large radiation exposures, and they've seen some of the highest body burden of that radiation in the thyroid gland, which is the gland in the middle of our neck that really regulates metabolism, among many other things. And so we know that the glands take up a lot of these toxins when we have them in the body, and that includes the ovaries, which then would lead to dysfunctions in a healthy menstrual cycle and an ability to get pregnant.
Mm-hmm. Can we get rid of these?
Yes. Yes, for the most part we can. We can't always mitigate all the damage that's been done by toxins in the body, and I personally don't think it's possible to get rid of all of them living in the world we live in. Mm-hmm. But we can optimize our body's ability to eliminate them. That's the way I always say it to my patients. So we work with the bowels, with the liver, with the kidneys. I always recommend sauna to people when they have a high toxic burden, because these are ways that help facilitate what your body's already trying to do.
Sweating is getting rid of stuff that you don't want in your body, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that's why sauna can be, there's more and more, again, research finally coming out about the benefits of sauna on some of the chronic disease states. And, for example, diabetes, we're finding more and more, is, of course, in some ways related to what we eat, in many ways related to what we eat and how much sugar we eat, mm-hmm. and carbohydrates and all that, but also very heavily related to our toxic burden. And, again, they found some of that information out from Vietnam veterans who are exposed to Agent Orange, finding that they had higher rates of diabetes because of those exposures. So, yeah, sauna is a great way for us to mobilize those toxins, and a fairly safe way for most people.
Yeah, my people are Swedish, Norwegian, and Finnish, and we have a strong sauna tradition, and
Yes. Everyone
in my family is like 104, so I'm like, that's good enough for me.
Yes!
Well, let's go back to where toxins are coming from. So you mentioned exogenous and endogenous. So exogenous means they're coming from the environment, what we're breathing, what we're eating, and I'm especially interested when you said copper, because we have a lot of copper cookware mm-hmm. in our world, and it's considered one of the better one of the higher end ways for gourmet cooking. Does that mean we shouldn't be cooking with copper?
I generally recommend that we don't cook directly on copper. So
okay.
I don't know. I'm not an expert necessarily on cookware, but I know that there are a lot of companies that make cookware with copper, like a copper insert, mm-hmm. basically. So there's a stainless steel surface that you're cooking on, which is safe. And then there's a copper insert, which allows for more equal heating mm-hmm. across the pan. So something like that I recommend. I also think, you know, I'm a naturopathic doctor, and I test people for levels of these toxins. And so I don't make every recommendation for every person. And in general, I say let's do what we can to reduce exposure. But also, if somebody's really high in copper, I'm going to really start asking a lot more questions about what are you cooking with, what is mm-hmm. in your water, etc.
Okay. So is there a test specific for everything? Like, do you test for copper, for aluminum, for cadmium, or can you kind of take one test and get a nice readout?
Yes. Either way, there's variety of tests for these things. There's blood tests, there's urine tests, there's hair tests. And so depending on what way you want to look at it, if I'm really concerned about an acute exposure to one of these toxins, for example, I'll look at it in the blood and see how are they being affected in the immediate sense. If I'm looking at the big picture of their health and trying to determine what is affecting them more than something else, you know, I'll do a hair analysis and look at it that way. So it just depends what lens we want to look through, but there are mm-hmm. multiple ways to look at these things.
Okay, and the key is to be treating each patient as
as an individual person.
Do you see big differences? A lot of times something that may be troublesome for somebody 70 and up is just not a problem for someone in their 30s. How about between men and women? Because we have very different metabolic rates for good reason.
Yes.
Do you see issues with toxins where there is a big disparity between men and women?
That's a good question. I don't. I just clinically what I'm seeing is a difference in the presentation of the symptoms that are related to the toxins. So, for example, infertility, I'm seeing more commonly among women. I might see more digestive distress among women, although I'm getting more and more men with that being their primary complaint. And then I'll see more of that diabetes picture more commonly with men, cardiovascular disease. And these are gross generalizations, mm-hmm. but it's more of the effects that I'm seeing on the body than one being more susceptible than another.
Because we process things a little differently. Heart attacks show up differently in women than they do in men.
Right.
Is this area, speaking of gross generalizations, are we more prone to certain exogenous toxins, like, I don't know, farm chemicals?
Yeah, that is the first thing that came to my mind as well. What I see, I talk to everyone about the water they're drinking, and we generally, I would say, as a community, don't think a lot about it. We think it's coming out of the tap, it must be safe. And even if it's coming out of a well, you know, I have a lot of patients coming from rural areas drinking well water, and I see a lot of high levels of copper, iron, which, again, those are both nutrients that we actually need.
We do need.
In the body, but the levels are way higher than what is healthy or optimal for mm-hmm. our bodies. And so I will often recommend they filter that water. Okay. In the city water, again, you know, I'm not somebody who analyzes water. That's not my area of expertise. But clinically, what I see is higher than what I think is healthy levels of aluminum, again, iron, copper, and manganese, which again is a nutrient our bodies need, but way higher than what is acceptable, mm-hmm. I think, for our body's optimal health. And so even city water, I recommend people filter that.
I feel like, and maybe I'm not correct, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like I see some of these in supplement form.
You're right.
Especially iron, I guess that one we can say for mm-hmm. sure. Does that mean we really shouldn't be taking those in supplement form?
That's a great question. So I'll say yes and no on that one.
Great. My favorite.
We need to be mindful of the type, like the form of the nutrient that we're taking in, and also whether or not we need it. So iron, for example, has a number of forms that we can supplement it in, has a number of forms that it's, you know, we're exposed to in the environment. And if we are exposed to and accumulate an unusable form of iron for our bodies, that's a toxin. If we are taking a supplemental form that's usable, that's a nutrient.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, you can have water and it's good for you. You can have too much water and it's bad for you.
Yes.
Okay. Now let's move on to endogenous. And this means produced by the body. What does that mean?
So one of the first things I think of, and you've heard me harp on this topic a fair amount, is the microbiome. So the natural picture of flora in the body. So when we eat foods that are not processed well, when we eat foods that cause us to be ill, you know, all the junk foods, say we eat junk food, we get basically a rotting in our digestive tract, right? Things are not processed efficiently. They sit there, they ferment, etc. So what happens there? What happens when something's rotting? It produces toxins. So it's a toxin, and the body then has an additional burden to get rid of. So that's one example of an endogenous toxin. Now, we also just, again, from normal enzymatic processes in the body, produce toxins, oxidants, you might call them, or free radicals. And those are during normal just metabolic processes when we're creating energy out of our food and nutrients. So ideally, the body would produce antioxidants, right, to neutralize those free radicals. But again, that idea of if there are too many of them for the body's burden, then that is what can cause damage. That leads to an inflammatory state, which we know is the underlying cause of many diseases. And inflammation is our body's way of defending against that oxidation.
Right. How often do you hear things like, oh, I'm just sore and I don't know why? Or I just always have headaches and I don't know why?
Every day, Ashley. Yeah, the bulk of my patient population is tired, mm-hmm. sore, belly achy, mm-hmm. not feeling good and don't know why.
Yeah.
But all their conventional lab measures look normal.
Okay.
Right? So they may even look fairly healthy, but they just don't feel good. And that's where a lot of this comes into play, is really getting down to these seemingly small day-to-day impacts on the body, mm-hmm. and how can we reduce the burden
and we want to be paying attention when the body, like if you're tired for no reason or headachy.
Yeah, the truth is there is a reason, right? We just haven't identified it yet.
Yeah, sure. Or how about, like, when you go to the bathroom, what should a healthy stool sample look like?
I love that question. So I usually say bowel movement 1 to 2 times a day. That's well-formed and easy to pass.
Soft serve ice cream.
Yeah, or even, you know, my colleague calls it brown bananas. She says it should look like a brown banana, which is actually pretty accurate.
Okay.
Now, is every bowel movement going to look that way? No, but if we're generally trending in that direction, we're probably on the right track.
Okay.
If we're either more towards soft serve ice cream or looser, mm-hmm. or more of a pellet mm-hmm. type stool, that's going to be less than optimal for our body's ability to eliminate.
Okay. What are some foods that you would recommend for helping your body with this? What should we be eating?
Yeah, great question. So that topic I could talk at length about, so I'll try to keep it brief. I think it's important to eat organic foods. The reason for that is that non-organic foods will contain pesticides, which are toxins and do all these things we've been talking about in the body. Avoiding things like hydrogenated fats and oils cause that inflammatory reaction I was talking about. When we get really fat-heavy foods, like, you know, animal products, the most delicious ones, which are I absolutely recommend eating. I think organic and grass-fed is the best option there, because most toxins are stored in fat tissue. And so if we're eating the fatty tissue of animals that have been treated with antibiotics and exposed to other toxins, feeding on grains that are full of pesticides, we will be eating those toxins along.
So you should have a healthy diet, and what you're eating should have a healthy diet.
Yes. Yes, it should.
Okay.
Filtering your water, I talked about. And then there's a lot of foods that we can eat that really help our bodies to process these things better. I'm a big fan of fiber. You know, there's a big movement towards more of a higher fat diet, a ketogenic diet, mm-hmm. which for some people I think is appropriate. But I think the key there, and really with any diet you choose to take, is high fiber. So the foods that help keep the stool regular.
Get your broccoli bind and your cabbage and your Brussels sprouts in there.
Yeah, and that's a whole nother level, those cruciferous vegetables.
And that
the
means
broccoli.
Raw? Or cruciferous Not, is just
Cruciferous
that
just means, yep, the Brassicaceae family, which are okay. broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, kale.
Okay.
And those have additional biochemical components that help to break down toxins and process them through the liver. So those foods are awesome. The sulfur-containing foods like garlic and onions are really important in our detox processes. So, you know, add garlic and onions to everything.
Perfect. I love garlic and onions. Dr. Swabany, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was naturopathic Dr. Ali Swabany, who practices at Prairie Naturopathic Doctors in Moorhead. There are also naturopathic practitioners in Fargo and Bismarck. Next on Main Street, a commentary from Mark Trahant.
Boys get the message at a young age, don't show your feelings, don't rely on anyone else. How do these messages affect them when they grow up?
One of the fixtures in the apartment was a post that runs floor to ceiling, and the post became my friend. I would hug the post. I would hug the post for all it was worth.
Rethinking what it means to be a man on the next Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, providing caregiving resources, healthy living information, tips for families to avoid scams, and connecting with communities at fun events. They're creating real possibilities here in North Dakota. AARP.org/ND.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today. He says the voices of indigenous peoples and leaders are more present in discussions about the future of the Arctic than in any other international conversation. And here's his commentary.
At the Arctic Circle Forum in Reykjavik, Iceland, the Prime Minister of Greenland, Kim Kielsen, spoke in an Inuit language. Indigenous leaders were prominent on stage, addressing the hundreds of leaders from governments, businesses, and nonprofits. Some 50 countries attended the annual event. The conference even ended with Inuit Night, a celebration of performers ranging from throat singers to Yupik rap. Yet, there could be so much more. Participants were standing room only in the conference hall when famous speakers represented current discourse, ranging from those calling for stronger action on global warming to those wanting energy development and increased shipping lanes because of global warming. That range of discussion is a good thing. But when the panels were on indigenous knowledge, youth, or governance, suddenly there were plenty of seats. The opening plenary included the wisdom of Inuit Circumpolar Chair Daly Sambo Doro, so late in the rotation that her prepared remarks had to be trimmed in order to keep to the schedule. So what does the indigenous thinking add to the conversation? It's a story about land, culture, and a sense of place where more than a third of the earth, over 80% of the planet's biodiversity, are from territories with indigenous peoples. Former Alaska Lieutenant Governor Valerie Davidson Yupik said Native people want what every other family wants. We want our children and our families to be healthy. We want them to be safe. We want them to be well-educated, and that's universal. We want all that, and we all serve that for our children and our families. However, because of where we live, and because of the resources we do and most often don't have, we have to do things in a different way. What happens in the Arctic will define the future of this planet. Inuit Chair Sambo Doro said, "The Arctic is critical to the entire globe. Science shows this with ocean currents, atmospheric currents, and other elements. But there is a connection, and it's also important to recognize our relationship to human rights that's interrelated, interdependent, and invisible." Doro said the Inuit occupy 40% of the Arctic, both in terms of land and the marine environment. So when we talk about this dynamic of the Arctic and against the backdrop of global geopolitical dimensions, Inuit have to have a seat at the table. She said we have to have a role. Or, as one Arctic Circle panel stated flatly, "Nothing about us without us." I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues online at IndianCountryToday.com. Next on Main Street, a natural North Dakota essay from Chuck Lura and a book for kids titled No Hugs. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Governor Burgum has signed a statewide disaster declaration, and that could mean forthcoming requests for federal help in dealing with flooding impacts of heavy fall rains and an early season blizzard. Burgum talked about the declaration at a meeting in Fargo.
We're quite good at dealing with floods in the spring, but when we do that, there's generally no crops in the field. We've got literally billions of dollars of agriculture value that is unharvested in the fields, and that's creates a risk potential for us, not just to, cities and people and infrastructure, but there's an economic hardship that we're facing here relative to this fall's harvest that is, likely unprecedented.
Burgum and other state officials are touring parts of the state hit hard by the blizzard and heavy rains. One is North Dakota Ag Commissioner Doug Goring.
We probably have in western Minnesota and in North Dakota about $2 billion worth of soybeans that are sitting in water or at least in conditions which may not allow producers to get out there and get them anytime soon.
Goring says that is causing a lot of anxiety among growers. Bobcat is expanding in Gwinner, North Dakota, a new high-tech powder coat paint line, and 30,000 square feet of manufacturing space will be added to the plant. Construction will get underway soon. The paint line upgrades will be done in three phases, with completion planned for July. With plants in Gwinner and Bismarck, Bobcat manufactures loaders, utility work machines, and attachments. The company is the largest manufacturer in the state, with more than 3,000 employees. And the Great Plains Food Bank has been in operation for 36 years and is marking a new milestone in providing food to those in need.
And today we are packaging up onto our semi the food for 175 millionth meal to be distributed across our service area of North Dakota and Clay County, Minnesota.
Marsha Paulson is Chief Development Officer for Great Plains Food Bank. She says with help from the food industry, the food bank rescues and redistributes surplus product. Paulson says each year, Great Plains Food Bank distributes more than 13 million meals, but reaching 175 million meals is unfathomable.
It is. Unfortunately, there's great need across North Dakota. People are making tough choices. Should they heat their house or apartment or eat? Do they feed their kids or do they have to skip a meal? Holidays are coming. Winter months are coming. It's a challenge for many folks who are working hard to meet the needs of their family.
The 175th million meal will be included in a shipment of products being delivered to the Ministry on the Margins food shelf in Bismarck. That delivery takes place tomorrow. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. A variety of wildlife makes a place more interesting. However, too much of one kind of wildlife can be an indication that nature's balance has been disrupted by a change in the environment. Wet weather, for example. Chuck Lura responded to a question from a listener about an abundance of toads in one part of the state, and that's the subject of today's Natural North Dakota.
I received an inquiry a few weeks ago concerning the abundance of toads near Kramer, North Dakota, in southern Bottineau County. It seems the toad population was experiencing some sort of an eruption, with the toads seemingly everywhere, including the highway. These toads were quite small and had a long extension, like a very long toe, on the hind leg. That's indicative of the plain spadefoot toad. The plain spadefoot is roughly 1.5 to 2 inches long, and as the name implies, has an extended digging spur or spade on their back feet. Unlike most toads, their skin is smooth, and they have a vertical pupil, like cats. Their color is variable, from gray to brown to perhaps creamy in color. Plain spadefoots are known to be explosive breeders, responding to wet periods where they utilize shallow and temporary standing water. They can develop from eggs to an adult within a month. The spadefoot has a scattered documentation in the state, but may be found mainly in the western half of the state and more to the south and west of the Missouri River. They are considered to be uncommon and locally abundant, usually in association with grasslands or sandy or perhaps gravelly soil. Four other species of toads may be observed in North Dakota, the largest of which is the Woodhouse's toad, which are about 4 inches long. They range mainly south and west of the Missouri River. There's also the Great Plains toad, 3 to 4 inches long, variable in color, which can be found across the state. The last two, the American and Canadian toads, are difficult to identify because they hybridize. They're between 2 to 3 inches long. However, the Canadian toad is more widespread, particularly north and east of the Missouri River. The American toad has a rather limited distribution, documented only in Cass, Richland, and Pembina counties. It's interesting to note that the Canadian toad has been associated with freckled areas, areas of land roughly 30 to 60 feet in diameter, where the soil is slightly elevated, forming a freckled signature on aerial photographs in Minnesota and also Rolette and perhaps Burke County. They appear to have formed from large numbers of toads digging into the soil in large numbers to hibernate. Over 3,000 toads were found hibernating in a mound in Minnesota during the 1960s. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botineau. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Grow with Google. Grow with Google will be in North Dakota the week of October 30th, offering digital skills workshops that can help grow one's career or business. Registration at g.co/grownorthdakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Not everyone loves hugs. Some doctors and counselors say we shouldn't force them upon kids. As a mom and a scientist, Deirdre Prishman-Voldseth noticed her second child didn't like hugs. She looked for books to help her child talk about it, and when she noticed there weren't any good options, she wrote one herself. She talks with R. Ashley Thornburg about her book, No Hugs.
Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Why did you want to write this book?
I think the initial thought behind it was I was trying to help kids navigate some of the life's trickier moments, and then it sort of progressed also to a book a little bit about body autonomy, mm-hmm. having kids think about consent, body consent, and kind of being okay with others having a different sort of ideas about what they want.
Yeah, hugs are so commonplace, and it, to me anyway, is fairly new in the public consciousness of maybe we should be paying a little bit more attention to this thing that nobody is thinking about.
Right.
Yeah, because think about any holiday.
There's kind of just an assumption that this is something that everybody does and that everybody's okay with it and comfortable with it. But I think you're right. We are beginning to pay a little bit more attention and to, I think, listen to kids more and to kind of take their wishes into consideration a little bit more. And it's the better idea to give the child a little bit more control over what is happening with their own body. This is, I think, something that comes into play at holidays, but also, you know, it could be like just friends greeting one another at school. It could be a birthday party. So the story is a little bit just kind of an average day. It's not really a holiday or anything. It's just a friend who's an enthusiastic hugger and her friend who is not that into hugging. One thing that I tried to build into the book that was that the girl who's not really into hugging, I didn't want her to have to justify that. She's just not into it. You know, there's no particular reason. She just doesn't feel like it. And I didn't want her to have a reason.
Right. It's not a skin condition that, you know, makes it hurt to touch it.
Correct.
This is just somebody who's not into it.
Yep.
So the characters, Alice loves hugs. Zara does not love hugs. It's a book geared for children, of course.
Mm-hmm.
There's big, bright, beautiful illustrations, bold lettering, but very few words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was able to read it in, 90 seconds? But it has a story arc to it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think we're going to give away too many spoilers here. Alice is trying and trying and trying to get Zara to give her a hug. And Zara is just not into it. Like you said, no excuses. And then eventually Alice gets upset.
Yes.
And then what happens?
Well, this is the part of the book that I really like because Alice becomes quite upset. Her feelings are a little bit hurt. Why doesn't her friend want to hug her? She's feeling a little bit rejected. And so there's this nice shift in perspective where Alice becomes so mad that her friend Zara is actually now kind of offering, hey, do you need a hug? And Alice is a little too angry. She doesn't want to be touched at the moment. And so it's this nice kind of role reversal, which I think it's nice for kids to kind of have different perspectives and to kind of think about, hey, what's the other person experiencing? It can kind of go a long way towards mutual understanding.
Yeah, it's that light bulb moment in Alice's head of like, oh, this is what it feels like to not want a hug. Zara just happens to feel that more than I do. Mm-hmm. And then they settle on a high five.
Yes.
And so the part, at least one of the morals of the story here is that a good hug or really any good physical contact needs to be between consenting people and mm-hmm. that it's just not the same mm-hmm. if one of them's just not into it.
Yes, I would definitely agree with that. And it's nice that they were able to find a way to kind of compromise and kind of come together at the end in a way that was acceptable to both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There is a little bit of science behind the power of hugging.
Mm-hmm.
There are some studies that show underneath the National Institutes of Health that hugging can reduce stress. It can build immunity. Oxytocin is released, which mm-hmm. is a stress-reducing hormone.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, hugs aren't bad necessarily.
No, not at all. And in fact, you're right. There is scientific evidence that shows how beneficial physical contact can be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the key here is that it has to be both parties need to be on the same page. So if it's a hug where one individual, it's a negative experience or they're not, they don't want that, then I think it could have the opposite effect.
Right. So it's not no hugs ever.
Right. And in this case, you know, Zara is just at this moment, she just doesn't feel like it. She's too hot, too cold, too tired. She's just not into it at this moment. That's not to say that perhaps the next day she would feel differently.
Kids are so in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, have you ever seen a kid go from laughing and having so much fun and then all of a sudden their friend shows up and their friend's in the same blue shirt and then it's just a disaster?
Yeah, very, very instantaneous. Yeah.
Well, we were talking a little bit before we started recording that the idea for this book came from your own children.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you have one who likes hugging and one who didn't.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Abby and Maddie. And so Abby is older. And when her little sister came along, she really loved her and wanted to show that affection through some hugs. But Maddie was not very receptive to that. And so she didn't want to be hugged at the moment. She was too busy with something else. And so I think, you know, there was a little bit of hurt feelings, and we had to have some conversations about the situation. And then it also stems in part from a birthday party where one of my daughters it was her birthday, and as a sign of thanks for each friend, she would give them a hug and just to say kind of thank you for coming and thank you for giving me a present. But there was a little boy there who did not want that. We kind of came up with an alternative solution, like maybe a high five would be something that he would be okay with. And that seemed to really do the trick. Like, I think he felt okay with that, felt included. And as a parent, it didn't really occur to me at the time when, you know, until that one child was sort of like, no. It was like, how can we include him in an
right.
appropriate way?
But included was exactly the word I was going to say, that kids want to be included in decision-making about mm-hmm. kids.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we oftentimes, we're the parents, we're smarter.
Having kids has really taught me to, you know, be a better listener. And, you know, things are very different now. In school, in child rearing, in our understanding of the world. And so it's really, like, I've really had to listen and navigate some of these situations. It's to my benefit.
And hugging is cultural. Travel around Europe, and you're not going to greet your friends by hugging. You're going to maybe give one kiss, two kiss, sometimes three, four. Sometimes it depends how much mm-hmm. wine is involved. But even just the cultural background of the way that we express affection varies greatly, even within this own country. Midwest, a little bit more guarded.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there can be all kinds of different hugs. Some people are like, come here, I'm going to give you a big squeeze. Other people are more, I will pat you on the back. Growing up, I always thought it was strange that people in other countries would greet each other by the kiss on the cheek. And I was like, what would I do if I was in that situation? I wouldn't know how to respond. And so it is quite interesting, the variation. Navigating that can be tricky. Yeah.
And especially because this has nothing to do with your professional life.
True.
You study bugs.
I'm an entomologist, so I study bugs at NDSU, and yep, it does not feature any bugs. But I think the way that I got into it, you know, I was always interested in writing stories even as a child. And then in graduate school, I started writing books for kids, but they were nonfiction books on insects.
Okay.
So I did kind of a series on, you know, ants, beetles, butterflies, a few others like dung beetles. It was called Poop Eaters, Dung Beetles in the Food Chain, and Goliath Bird-Eating Spiders and Other Extreme Bugs. And so I had done those. It's been about 10 years ago that I did those. And so then I had kind of taken a break, and I came back to writing children's books. It was probably about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. I just kind of got interested in it again and found a great community here. There's actually a Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators that's nationwide, but they have different regional chapters. And so there's a Dakotas chapter, and I joined that group. A great learning opportunity, a great community of fellow writers, just a really wonderful group of people out, you know, writing books for kids. And, you know, there's webinars and conferences and critique groups. And it was really instrumental in kind of building this, kind of revitalizing this career for me, the writing career.
Yeah. Has it changed at all your approach to education? Because you are an associate professor in the Department of Entomology at North Dakota State University. And, you know, when you have your doctorate, there is definitely a level of intellectual depth. And as an educator and as a mother, you have to be able to say things simply.
You know, I would really say that both aspects, the writing and the professional entomologist, they've really kind of operated synergistically. So they've really built on one another. So as part of my job, I do, you know, research, and part of my job is teaching. I teach general entomology and principles of insect pest management. And so thinking about teaching and how things are communicated in that realm, in the university realm, has kind of helped me think about the structure of books and how information is conveyed that way. And likewise, learning about plot structure, word choice, implications of phrasing, pacing, character development, all of those things has really helped inform my thoughts about teaching and my thoughts about, you know, kind of writing articles for a scientific audience. It's kind of been fun because at scientific conferences, you often will present research in the form of a poster. And I got inspired one at the last conference to actually do sort of more like a graphical poster. It's almost like a comic or like a graphic novel. I don't think I would have thought of before if I hadn't been involved with the writing community.
Yeah,
but it's just kind of a fun way to make information a little bit more accessible, whether you're a scientist or whether you're not. Yeah.
What was the process of getting this published, and how does that compare to like scholarly research?
It's quite different, and the publishing world is actually quite involved. And I think at the time when I wrote the books about insects, I really was clueless. Like, I really didn't understand the publishing world. Like, those particular books were called Work for Hire, where the publisher kind of has the idea, and they had a template. They kind of had, you know, here's generally the framework of what we want you to write, and we'll pay you a flat fee to do so. So it's kind of a work for hire. And then in the publishing world, there's a lot of different publishing houses, and some you need an agent to be able to work with. And some publishers, generally the smaller presses, don't require you to have an agent. And so that is a big deal. Like, getting an agent is really difficult. I currently actually am looking for an agent. The press that published No Hugs, Amicus Inc., it's out of Mankato, Minnesota. They accept submissions from writers who don't have agents. But some of those larger presses, you need an agent. Like, you cannot contact them directly, or it's rare that they would accept unsolicited manuscripts. And then, of course, publishing in the science world, it's even different than that. Generally, with a scientific publication, like a journal article, you're going to submit that to a peer-reviewed journal, and there's a lot of stuff that you do on your end, and then it goes through a peer review process. Other scientists will look at it, give you feedback, but ultimately, you know, once your manuscript is, if it's deemed worthy of publication in that particular journal, it's accepted, and then you have to pay to get it published. So, but it's the currency of science, so.
Yeah, you have to get published a lot. Especially if you're tenured, right?
Yeah.
We're visiting with Deirdre Prishman Voldseth. She is the author of No Hugs, a kid's book about friendship and understanding and acceptance, especially when friends want different things out of life. How'd you find your illustrator?
The publishers do that. In some cases, the publisher will ask for the author's input. Amicus Inc., they said, hey, I identify this illustrator who's fabulous, Sarah Jennings. She lives in London, and she just did a great job on this book.
Saw one of the reviews on the website Goodreads, and I just got a kick out of this. It was a woman who said, how did they write my autobiography? So there's kind of this finally moment.
Yeah, it was interesting because, you know, you're supposed to kind of look at the market, see what kind of books out there are similar to yours, maybe come up with some comparison or comp titles when you're pitching your book to a publisher. And as I was sort of doing research on that, I noticed there were a lot of books on Porcupine Wants a Hug, books where hugging is the norm. And there didn't seem to be very many books where hugging was not the norm, or it was kind of the flip of that everybody wants a hug kind of scenario.
What was your kids' reaction?
I think they thought it was really cool. Like, they were pretty excited, just happy. And then they went on to, this is great. Okay, now I'm going to go play. They keep it real.
Yeah. Kids will keep you humble in a hurry. Mm-hmm. Deirdre, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Deirdre Prishman Voldseth, author of No Hugs, talking with Ashley Thornburg. The book is available at the NDSU Bookstore, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Target.com. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, a Touchstone energy cooperative generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 21st. There have been times in North Dakota when students in public schools regularly recited the Pledge of Allegiance as a patriotic classroom habit. With hands over hearts, young people saluted the Star-Spangled Banner, vowing loyalty to country and flag. It was on this date in 1892 that school children in the state spoke the allegiance for the first time, commemorating Columbus Day. The pledge was written by Francis Bellamy and disseminated by a magazine called The Youth's Companion. U.S. President Benjamin Harrison issued a proclamation in 1892 recommending the observance of the 400th anniversary of Christopher Columbus finding the American continents. President Harrison instructed citizens nationwide to celebrate the day with suitable exercises in the schools. Francis Bellamy, representing the Youth's Companion magazine, provided every American school with an official program for Columbus Day observances. The program included a short and concise salute to the flag, the first version of the Pledge of Allegiance.
In North Dakota, Jamestown school administrators, townspeople, and students followed the first steps of the official program precisely. Local military veterans raised a new American flag over the high school, and as the flag reached the top of the staff, the veterans led the assemblage in 3 cheers for Old Glory. Immediately afterwards, the pupils pledged allegiance to the banner, following the instructions from the official program, with every pupil giving the flag a military salute, right hand lifted, palm downward. Standing thusly, they cited the pledge. I pledge allegiance to my flag and the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Other towns in the state also included the new pledge on that Columbus Day. Students at Cole Harbor, north of Washburn, had raised money to buy a big flag, 20 feet long, and then flew it on Columbus Day after reciting the salute to the flag. As the years passed, the Pledge of Allegiance changed. In 1924, the words, "The Flag of the United States of America," replaced "My Flag." In 1942, the U.S. government officially recognized the pledge. In 1954, Congress revised it to read, "One Nation Under God." Eventually, many North Dakota schools required a daily pledge. Today, reflecting changing times, citing the pledge in classrooms is voluntary. Today's Dakota Daybook is written by Dr. Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
I'm Peter Sagal, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. To most broadcasters, you are just an eyeball, which they want to monetize. Sounds painful. NPR doesn't want to monetize any of your body parts. We broadcast things we think are interesting or important, or in my case, funny or ridiculous, because we hope you'll feel the same way. We do deep and probing interviews, and we snicker at words like deep and probing. We make the radio we want to hear. This is NPR.
On the next Morning Edition, catching a spy is no easy task. Now computers can be programmed to find insider threats.
They don't just predict the future, they cause the future.
But are their conclusions reliable? Also, a new HBO series puts a different spin on superheroes.
Shouldn't we be a little worried about people who put on masks?
Listen for all kinds of stories on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, Prairie Pulse host John Harris talks with David Borlaug, president of the Lewis and Clark Fort Mandan Foundation and the director of Capitol Gallery West, a fine arts facility that opened in Medora during the tourist season in the summer. Tom Eason will share a Plainsfolk essay titled Cry of the Plover, and Dr. Judith Orloff will return with another discussion of empathy and how being an empath can stress a person out. Her new book is Thriving as an Empath. 365 days of self-care for sensitive people. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.